October 20, 2011, City Council Retreat at the Arboretum, Dallas, Texas.
Okay, I think we've got everybody. Jerry's there. Scott is watching. Scott's here. We're here.
We're the Rainbow Club.
Well, welcome to our planning offsite. Let me just kind of go over what we're going to be trying to accomplish. This afternoon is we get to sit and listen and just learn and try to expand our minds, really. That's the purpose of today, is to sit back and to be the foundational work for our thinking tomorrow. Tonight we will then break and have cocktails outside so we can get the nice and weather and have a good dinner. First of all, I want to thank Mary and your staff for choosing this place. I think this is beautiful and great decision. We look forward to having a good day. And then tomorrow is work day, and we'll go through the agenda of that in the morning. I'm saying that just to say relax right now, and we'll introduce our speakers one at a time. And I assume we can ask questions whenever we want, right? I think, at the end, you want to do it at the end?
At the end of the speaker.
Okay, at the end of the speaker. All right. So, Mary, you want to introduce our first speaker?
For the important things first, there's a cookie tray on its way too. So,
the bowl of water.
I want to introduce to you our first speaker, Molly Foley. And you were like, I was when I walked in. I was looking for something that looked like this with the long hair. She's cut her hair, so she's the same person. And I'm sure you read about her background, but she's really been dedicated to building better places to live and work and focusing on the next generation. And used to work for a chamber. Her husband's a council member, but she's one of us. She's kind of a tribe, so that's good. She works in an area on the Illinois-Iowa border, the Illinois Quad area. And there's five cities, in the step club.
Yep.
They have about 400,000 people in them. So a metro area, so she's familiar with a lot of that. We heard her speak at an ICMA conference, that's the International City Managers Association conference. Jill came back and talked about how good it was, but then my other colleagues from other cities that I was talking were talking about their company and their speech and their thoughts, and so I was really excited about sharing it with you. So, Molly, it's all yours.
Thank you, Mary. Appreciate that. Can everyone hear me okay? I tend to project well, so I'm not going to stand behind the podium there. But thank you all for welcoming me here. It's great to be here down in Dallas. It was also great to be able to catch a direct flight down here this morning. We have great direct service from the Quad Cities region down to DFW. So arrived here mid-morning and have enjoyed the general area around the Botanical Center this morning, and now it's great to be here with all of you this afternoon. Mary asked me to come down here, and Jill, and I've been working with John as well, to come down here and talk about, really the next generation and trends. So I want to spend our time together today talking about, giving you some perspectives around who your next citizens are, who this next generation is, so to speak. What's their characteristics? How do they see the world? What do they value? I want to also talk about, some of the trends currently shaping our cities and shaping this next generation. And then kind of help put it into a nice pretty package for you and talk about, what it means for your planning, as this is obviously the kickoff of your planning retreat here. So, and then we'll have some Q&A time. So I hope that sounds good for everybody. Some of this, I'm going to give you some general overviews, and other parts I'll dive in a little bit deeper. But I want to start by talking about, who are your next citizens? Who is this next generation, and how do they see the world? And when I'm talking about the next generation, I'm typically talking about today's, what we would classify as millennials, or sometimes Generation Y. And some generation experts spell it either Generation Y, just as the letter, or Generation Y, W-H-Y, because they ask so many questions. how many of you might be owners of the next generation? Okay, so you know maybe who I'm talking about here. The other thing to consider whenever we're talking about generations is, you know, even though you can talk about some general generational characteristics, people go through different life stages. So you have to take into account that people might be, you know, within their generation, but they're going to change, and those characteristics are going to shift a little bit based on what life stage they might be in. So I want to first share with you that, you know, this is a very optimistic generation. You're looking at next citizens who, you know, have some hope for the future, who are optimistic. And I want to share, that to help kind of stress my point with this, I brought some voices of the next generation. And the first voice that I brought is, we'll kind of share with you how the next generation perceives the world that they're going to inherit. This is actually developed by a millennial for an art contest, actually, believe it or not. And it's a palindrome. Does everyone know what a palindrome is? It means that it's a poem that basically reads the same way backwards as it does forward. And so I want to share with you, I do apologize, it might be a little bit difficult to read, but hopefully you'll all be able to hear this fine.
I am part of a lost generation, and I refuse to believe that I can change the world. I realize this may be a shock, but happiness comes from within is a lie. Money will make me happy. So in 30 years, I will tell my children they are not the most important thing in my life. My employer will know that I have my priorities straight because work is more important than family. I tell you this, once upon a time, families came together, but this will not be true in my era. This is a quick fix society. Experts tell me 30 years from now, I will be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce. I do not concede that I will live in a country of my own making. In the future, environmental destruction will be the norm. No longer can it be said that my peers and I care about the earth. It will be evident that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It's foolish to presume that there is hope. And this will all be true unless we reverse it. There is hope. It is foolish to presume that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It will be evident that my peers and I care about this earth. No longer can it be said that environmental destruction will be the norm. In the future, I will live in a country of my own making. I do not concede that 30 years from now, I will be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce. Experts tell me this is a quick fix society, that this will not be true in my era. Families stayed together once upon a time. I tell you this. Family is more important than work. I have my priorities straight, and my employer will know they are not the most important thing in my life. So in 30 years, I will tell my children, money will make me happy is a lie. Happiness comes from within. I realize this may be a shock, but I can change, and I refuse to believe I'm part of the lost generation.
Again, this is a very optimistic generation. In fact, in Canada, millennials are often referred to as the sunshine generation because of this optimism, because they see the world and they see all the issues that maybe we have to deal with, and they still have hope. And we need to be, very thankful for that. You know, as community leaders, as elected officials, you should be wanting to embrace that optimism of the next generation. You know, that will help keep the momentum for Dallas moving forward. Another thing about this generation, this is a generation where their skills are deeply embedded in technology. You know, we're talking about a generation who doesn't remember a time without cell phones, without Facebook, without the internet. So their skill sets and their lives are very much embedded into technology. In fact, when millennials are asked, what would you rather give up, coffee, chocolate, or their mobile phone? And all of them will say, I'll give up chocolate or coffee. I will not let go of that mobile phone. Because their mobile devices are sometimes the most intimate relationships they might have. That's how they are connecting to the world. That's how they're living. Right now, there are actually more mobile phones in the world than there are televisions. but that's a pretty big generational shift right there. So you can see how life online really is life. It's living to this generation. And I did bring just a few clips, you know, video clips, so just to kind of help stress my point here. And I want to share this commercial. It might be familiar to some of you. I absolutely love this commercial. It's a Toyota commercial, and I'm not here to sell Toyotas, but it's just a great commercial that has a great message about this next generation.
I read an article, well, I read the majority of an article online about how older people are becoming more and more antisocial. So I was really aggressive with my parents about joining Facebook. My parents are up to 19 friends now. I have 687 friends. Listen to her name. Not a real puppy. Call me a real puppy.
Toyota Venza. Keep on rolling.
There's a few messages really with that commercial. One, where did she read the article?
Online.
And she didn't read it in its entirety. Did you catch that as well? So that's one that's one message of this. You know, a lot of, I'm 37 by the way, and you know, I obviously still remember the time when we got our news from paper newspapers, and we read the books from paper copies, the, you know, hardcovers or softbacks. And the next generation, that's not how they get their news. You know, they are completely embedded in technology in that sense. There's a second message here as well, and that the obvious one of where, you know, she has 687 friends online via Facebook. Again, and she considers that living. Those are her social connections. She has expanded. There's this huge social graph. Those social connections with this next generation are expanding, and growing. The map of that is so much larger than maybe your social connections because of their deeply embedded technology skill set and the fact that they live online. I want to share one more video clip here because it's the beginning part of my remarks. And, you know, I want you to just think of, watch this clip and think about it when you're thinking about planning for the next generation. You know, the next generation being referred to as millennials, but, you know, after millennials, those who are now under the age of 10, generational name, yet, you know, there's some being thrown out there, yet to really settle in on one. And I want to share this clip of a two-year-old being introduced to an iPad for the very first time. It's amazing. You know, she's never seen this technology and watched the
new toy. Are you ready for a new toy? Do you like new toys?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want a new one?
Yeah.
Okay. Here it is.
It's a tower.
She recognizes
the
game. Yep. It's got a
super
tower on it.
A movie.
She quickly figure out. Her dad has not told her how to do that. She's figuring it out.
Dad, why is the movie so
cool? Here, I'll help you.
She found a drawing app, realizing, oh, I can draw with this. Her dad has to help her out a little bit here, but she sees this cat game that she's familiar with.
Do you want to go back to the dog and cat app?
Yeah.
Click the button.
Mm-hmm.
The big button at the bottom there. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Now click the cat. You'll be all set.
Thank you. She goes back to her lion app or the cat app.
Oh, no. Hold on. Yeah, there you go. Now hit the cat. Touch the cat's face. There you go.
Ow. Immediately knows what to do with those letters.
I.
Can I have a game?
A.
Yep.
I'm going to tap stop it there, but you know, I mean, that's pretty amazing. This 2.5-year-old, never seen this technology before, and can completely navigate her way through it. So if we think that these millennials, this current next generation, has some deeply embedded skills in technology, just wait for this generation to really start coming of age. And you know, they're coming out of the womb, really, with this type of technology and this skill set. Another thing we have to consider and keep in mind about the next generation is they value this live first, work second mentality. Where they live is as important, if not sometimes more important, than where they work. You know, they want to live in places that, you know, feel alive. They want to be in cities where they feel that the best days are still to come for their cities. Fun cities. Cities with great quality of life, great quality of place attributes that they can be connected to. You know, they understand and they don't want to, you know, they mold their work life around their social life, around their life outside of work. So, you know, as elected officials, you know, you should be asking yourself, you know, how can you create a culture in Dallas that's positive, that's vibrant, that's, you know, fun for the next generation, that's fun through the lens of the next generation. That's something you should be considering while you're doing your planning as well. You know, this is a generation where, you know, really adulthood has been pushed back. And Rebecca Ryan, our firm's founder, she founded Next Generation in 1998, actually, on April Fool's Day. And she tells this great story about a friend of hers who was at church one day with her family, with her kids. And the minister was telling a story, was preaching from the pulpit and, you know, said, Moses left home when he was 40. Jesus left home when he was 30. And her friend looked down the road to her kids and said, we are going for Jesus. You know, adulthood has been pushed back, and it's not always by choice. You know, the next generation, you know, those milestones, so to speak, of adulthood, you know, graduating school, getting a full-time job, owning one's own home, having kids, you know, a lot of those milestones have had to be pushed back with this generation. You know, they're entering this work world, they're graduating college with more college debt than any generation before that. And quite honestly, they just feel like they've been, you know, handed a really bad crap sandwich, so to speak, with this economy. They can't find jobs. And so they are having to push back adulthood. And, you know, they're living somewhere between, like, teenagerhood and adulthood. And sociologists out there actually developing this new sector, and they're calling it emerging adulthood. So, again, adulthood being pushed back, you know, 30 is the new 20 in many ways. Then I'm approaching 40, and, you know, I'm proud to say, you know, 30 is the new 40 in that sense as well. This is also a very skeptical, did I mess that up? You know what I mean. This is a very skeptical generation. You know, they are painfully aware that many of the systems that have been, you know, that society has been built on are broken, are not going to be there for them, maybe, as they get older. Or they just are not working from their perspective. This is one of my favorite quotes or statistics, actually, that came out of the U.S. Bureau of Labor Stats several years back. This is based on the Generation X statistic. And when you know, think of it this way in terms of their the skeptical nature of this next generation. We hear Next Gen, for instance, one recently asked us, you know, or said, you know, I just don't understand, why is it that I have to go and vote in person on the first or second Tuesday in November, in person, but yet I can go online and get a $300,000 mortgage from my bank with one or two clicks of the mouse. So there's you know, an issue in their perspective with that. You know, these systems just aren't working in their mind. They see them as broken. You know, so it's bringing this healthy skepticism into play in terms of how they are viewing society. Now, you know, with those general characteristics, you know, it's not just fair to say, okay, you know, here's the next generation wrapped up in, you know, some bubble wrap or a nice little bow. Now, you know who they are. Now go figure it out. Go plan for them. You know, in fairness, we have to understand that, you know, the next generation impacts friends. The next generation impacts society. All generations impact society. And society impacts all generations' perspective. So I want to put that into a little bit of context with talking now about some of these trends that are facing today's world, today's cities, and talk about them in terms and in context of the next generation. And the first trend is this. We are currently in a winter. And is anyone familiar with The Fourth Turning? Has anyone read the book The Fourth Turning? This is a book by William Strauss and Neil Howe. They've done a lot of generational research. When we talk about the generations, we typically are using their birth years, the birth ranges for each generation. Well, in 1997, Strauss and Howe published this book called The Fourth Turning, and they predicted this. Around the year 2005, a sudden spark will catalyze a crisis mood. Remnants of the old social order will disintegrate. Political and economic trust will implode. Real hardships will beset the land with severe distress that could involve questions of class, race, nation, and empire. In this book, they predicted a few things happening. The first was a financial crisis. You know, think the bank bailout. The second was the national health pandemic. You know, think the recent H1N1, you know, swine flu scares. And the third thing they actually predicted was a tea party. So it's interesting because you can ask yourself, you know, one, does this sound a little bit familiar right now with today's, you know, how America is looking right now, what's happening in America today? And, you know, you can ask yourself, one, how could these gentlemen have known? You know, how, you know, and if they, you know, why wasn't then this shared more? Or, you know, how was this indeed predicted? And how this came to be and how this is predicted is the fact is that, you know, every generation brings societal shifts to it. And societal shifts, you know, they move, they rotate with the generations. And every generation, every fourth generation repeats itself. So the children of today's millennials will look a lot like my parents who are traditionalists. Today's millennials look a lot like the lost generation, the generation prior to the traditionalists. And I want to give talk about these four, so it's a you know, with these four generational shifts and the turning, I want to talk about these four turnings that Strauss and Howe talk about. And I'm going to use them in perspective of seasons, because I think it's just easy to understand that way. So the first turning is spring. You know, spring's a time of amazing awakening. You know, it's a time, you know, in this sense, America had its spring in post-World War II when the silent generation, when the traditionalists were coming of age. You know, everything felt possible, you know, after the victory of the war, so to speak. You know, things were possible. This is when a lot of new realities, when a lot of our economic and social systems came into place. Things started to evolve. You know, people were, you know, prosperous. They felt, you know, connections in the land, so to speak. Now, summer always follows spring, and when you look at summer, summer brings a huge euphoria, you know, some sense of defiance in that way too, you know. And what I mean by that is, you know, it brings a sense that things are good, but they could be better. Baby boomers came of age during America's summer, so this was, prosperous post-war time, you know, they're coming of age, they, you know, during this make love, not war era. The boomers marched for more equality. They, you know, the civil rights movement. The boomers opened up the table, opened up more seats at the table for many people, you know, such as in city councils. A lot of our diversity within city councils is indirectly, we have to thank the boomers for that. because they saw the change that needed to happen, and they got up there and marched and led that change, leading up, you know, leading from the past previous spring, so to speak. And amazing things happen in the summer. But after summer, what comes next, obviously, and that's fall. And in this, the third turning, fall, so to speak, this is when Generation X came of age. And this was a time, you know, when there was a lot of, an era of separation. There was anxiety in the nation. You know, they came of age when things just started to really show signs of deterioration. You know, think the missing children, think the farm crisis, mid-80s recession. This was the time frame that Gen Xers were coming of age. They saw divorce rates soaring during this time frame. You know, they had to have family units shifted. This was a time when more and more households had both parents in the workforce, very different from previous generations. And it brought some feeling of separation and anxiety. And what obviously comes after fall, and that's winter. You know, winter hits, and that's the turning, so to speak. That's the season we are currently in. And it's right on time with this generational shift, with this, the fact that the millennials are now coming of age during a time of winter. And winter, you know, us up north, we view winter as, you know, we just count the months for, you know, the days until spring, quite frankly, up there. But, you know, it's a time of rest. It's a time of respect. You know, it's you know, the grass looks dead, but it's not. It's simply regathering, redeveloping itself underground, so to speak. We know spring will come again. And this is the time that we're in currently. And, you know, during winter, this is when, you know, social systems will change. Things will shift. This is when hard decisions of change need to be made. This is really, you know, what you should be thinking about in terms of how can we set ourselves up so we can have a prosperous spring and move on into summer, so to speak. Based on Strauss and Howe's prediction and in the fourth turning, they say that it will be 2015 most likely or later before we start to really come out of winter and see spring. Second trend. The aging and diversifying of America. Simply put, America is getting older and more diverse. We see this all over the country. Bruce Katz with the Brookings Institute, in his publishing, you know, he talks about this as a national transformation. You know, the United States is undergoing the most significant socio-demographic shift, you know, since the early 20th century. In fact, 83% of America's population growth over the past decade was because of ethnic minorities in the U.S. It's this transformation, it really truly is a transformation for our country here. This is a map that I pulled off of Texas Wide Open. One of the, you guys have a lot of, you know, great economic websites out there with data available. Cash off for that. But this is a map showing the diversity ranges in the United States. And it's the percentage of time two randomly selected people would differ by race or ethnicity. The bluer the state, the higher the diversity. In Texas, you would range 50 to 73% of the time you would have two randomly selected people differ in diversity. You can see here, you know, that it's really these most populated states, New York, Illinois, the states here in the South, with a lot of the population that have the most diversity. Trend three, the social media trend and how it leads to localization. Facebook is now 6 years old. And when you think about when Facebook developed, first of all, who all has a Facebook page? Do all of you, as like council people, have your own board page or district page? Okay. You know, it's 6 years old now. And when Facebook was to, you know, develop, as well as some other forms of social media, you know, at that time we thought, hey, wow, this is great. This is opening up our connections. This is creating a more global world, giving us more opportunities to connect more globally. Again, back to that expanding social graph in many ways. But what's interesting, this what this social media trend is currently doing is it's offering more opportunities for stronger local connections to be made. More people are using social media to localize and come together under common causes and things, you know, that bring people together to help shift and bring some social change to the current order of things, so to speak. I don't know how you all might feel about this next slide, but I just wanted to bring something, you know, that is a social media localized example here. You know, consider the recent Occupy Wall Street movement that got going. And with the use of social media, you've seen this Occupy Dallas happening. You know, this social media is being utilized as the new open space, the new whiteboard, so to speak, where people are coming together, sharing thoughts, sharing ideas. And, you know, this is not the most, they don't even know really what they're trying to be organized around yet. They're just utilizing these platforms to get broader voices, more people together. So you see these tools of social media, such as Twitter and Facebook, being used as catalysts to localize people and bring a larger, maybe, voice to the table, so to speak. Another example of this technology, social media, and localization is this .gov or iCitizen movement. I don't know if this has been discussed within any of your previous discussions or meetings, but people are finding ways to, you know, hack into our systems or improve our city systems with the use of technology. And a great example of this was actually an article that ran in Fast Company back in November 2010. And it was about a gentleman, his name's Ben, and he lived in a city out on the East Coast. And, you know, he lived in this neighborhood, and he just got kind of tired, you know, fed up with seeing all this graffiti popping up, you know, the blight in the community. So he decided to take his technical skills and create an app that would allow people to use their smartphone, their camera, to take a picture. And this app utilized the camera mechanism and actually GPS technology for people to be able to take a picture and immediately send that to City Hall, and that photo would show up in whoever inbox with the photo, and it's the exact GPS locate the coordinates of where that photo was located. So then the city could immediately address it. It didn't, no one had to wait. A great example of just of the next geners, you know, trying to take it upon themselves to improve some of our systems and how maybe things get done. Another great example of localization. And you might hear that example and think, you know what? You know, we don't need an app to be able to help our city run better. And that might absolutely be true. But I want you to think of this social media and localization in this way. You know, one, you can either think of it like as a river. And you could put this river, you know, running through Dallas and put a dam at it. Or right before it gets here, put a dam there so it will stay out or it will slow down. Or you can choose to jump in that river and be ahead of the trend and be, you know, a city that's helping create that culture. So think of it that way. You know, stay ahead of the culture in terms of the social media and localization by helping be the ones creating the culture, utilizing it to your advantage. Trend four, urbanization and the talent dividend. This is kind of one trend but broken into two parts. Urban populations are simply, you know, getting bigger. Our cities are getting larger. Today, 50% of the world's citizens live in large cities, such as Dallas. And what's interesting about this growth standpoint is Cleaver's Law. Does that sound familiar to anybody? It's kind of a really dry law, so to speak. But what it states is, an animal's metabolic rate scales to the 3/4 power of an animal's mass. That's a cat having a mass 100 times that of a mouse will have a metabolism roughly 31 times greater than that of a mouse. Basically, what this means is that, you know, even though the cat is 100 times greater than the mouse, it doesn't need to have a metabolism 100 times greater than the mouse. So this gentleman here, Jeffrey West, who works at a think tank called the Santa Fe Institute, he decided, you know what, I want to see how this Siebert law applies to cities, or if it applies to cities. And in his research, what he found was that when a city doubles in size, it requires approximately an increase in resources of only 85%. Furthermore, you know, you can look at another way of this urbanization and growth in this sense, too. So America's 100 largest metropolitan areas currently account for two-thirds of the population and generate about 75% of our gross domestic product currently. Those are metro areas, and Dallas is ranked fourth in terms of size of metro areas, not the city, just the Dallas. Obviously, that's the entire metro, larger metro NSA demographic. Those are rankings from the 2010 census. The other component of this urbanization and cities are getting larger is the fact of, we have to think about the talent dividend and the talent that's within those cities that are getting larger. Studios for cities, I don't know if that sounds familiar to anybody, but in their research out there, they have found that 58% of a city's success can be directly attributed to post-secondary degree attainment, to knowledge workers in your city. They call this the talent dividend. I'm not, they've gone on talent dividend tours. I'm not sure if they've ever come through Dallas here. But what this talent dividend is for every 1% increase in the number of residents who hold bachelor's degrees, there is a $763 increase in annual regional per capita income, or annual per capita income. So I did some calculations for you for the city of Dallas. So for Dallas, increasing the educational attainment of just 1% of your population, and this does not mean attracting more people into the city with these degrees. This means taking your current population and growing and, you know, getting their educational attainment higher. So by just increasing that, 1% of your current population brings an additional $940 million in income per year for Dallas residents. And if you were to take like a conservative 1.2 economic calculator of that, it would be about $1.1 billion economic impact generated for the city annually, just by increasing that educational attainment, shifting that 1% to the positive side of things. You know, the reason why you see this big impact is because all residents are impacted by an educated workforce. Those are the, you know, residents who are creating the jobs, who are out there, you know, creating innovation and plugging all residents into those opportunities. So it's a positive shift that the more education you can bring to your current residents. The fifth and final trend to touch on here is the quality of life. Quality of life attracts your next citizen. And when you think about quality of life, jobs absolutely play into that. The fact is that you know, more and more quality of life, the broader picture of quality of life, is what's going to drive your population, what's going to retain people here and attract those transplants to the area. And all cities are unique and different. You know, all cities, they have different types of people looking for different types of quality of life attributes. So the more broader, you know, of a quality of life you can offer, you would think maybe that would mean, you know, the more attractive you are. And yes, that can be, but not necessarily. And I want to talk about these quality of life attributes. At Next Generation Consulting, you know, we've been, again, working with cities, with companies, helping them understand this next generation. And since 1998, we've conducted over 50,000 interviews with this under 40 demographic, starting with Gen Xers, moving on to millennials, and asking them, you know, why do you call your city home? What attracts you to your city? What goes into, you know, a place to call home for you, a strong quality of life? And all the attributes they shared with us over the years have been grouped into 7 indexes. These attributes all fall into these seven indexes, and we've actually created a way to quantify a community's quality of life by pulling data points with those different attributes. And this is what I want to spend the remainder of our discussion talking about, and then go into some questions for you. The first of the seven indexes is this: cost of lifestyle. This is obviously a no-brainer. You know, the next generation specifically, they want to live in a community where they can afford to live, where you know, the cost of lifestyle is reasonable, where they can afford rent, where they can maybe afford to own a home and still get out and about and enjoy that lifestyle. I brought along some quotes from our research, from interviews we've done, from surveys we conducted from the next generation. And this person, you know, said, you know, I want to be able to afford a home and a night out on the town, simply put. They want to be able, you know, they view cost of lifestyle not just as the general, you know, standard cost of living indicators. They're looking at it from a broader perspective as well. Next index is the earning index. So what's the quality and diversity of the job opportunities? What's the breadth and depth of career opportunities in Dallas? This is something that the next generation is looking at, because they don't just want to be able to move to a community right out of college and start their job. They want to be able to grow in their job. So if a city is set up with only entry-level positions, you know, then they're going to hit a career ceiling and have to move on. They're going to have to move on move on from maybe that specific career or move out of Dallas. So they're looking at the earning opportunities within the community. And they're also trying to see what's the balance, what's the median income, and is it in balance with the cost of living? Again, you know, showing that balance there. Some of the things, common things we hear about from communities is the fact that, you know, if they don't want to work for one employer for the rest of their life, or, you know, just within one occupation, then they do have to, you know, decide to pick up and move away. This is something that the next generation, though, is looking again for more of those broader opportunities so they can stay put. This is a very loyal, particularly millennials, they're more loyal than us experts have been in terms of jobs as well as community. The third index is around vitality. You know, how healthy is the community? How committed to a healthy lifestyle is the region? This is something that's very important to the next generation, not only from the perspective of maybe the environment, some of those environment measures, but also from a recreational standpoint. Are people out and about enjoying the community? Are there great parks and are people out using them? And are they all interconnected? This is something that's very important for the next generation. A lot of things that we hear, particularly around green space, bike trails and stuff in the area, is that maybe, you know, the city has a lot, but none of them are connected. So you have to actually pick up and load your bike into your car and drive to actually go biking somewhere. And that doesn't really make sense to the next generation. They want to be able to experience a whole, array of recreational opportunities that are connected to one another, not have to, like, have them in pocket. So think about that in your planning. How well is Dallas's green space connected through the trails and other entities? Another thing we have to remember within this vitality index is, again, back to that adulthood has been pushed back by the next generation. And we hear this a lot. Now, I don't know how Dallas's dog parks are now that working in this community, but people love their dogs. I love my dog. My husband and I don't have children. We both travel too much. But I love my dog, and he is spoiled. He's at daycare right now. He is spoiled. He plays with his friends. We take him to the dog park. And these, you know, next geners, dog parks are just one, example. They're looking for great farmers markets. Dog parks are just another way for them to connect to other dog lovers. Farmers markets are a great way for them to connect to other people in the community that value maybe buying local. Again, all back to those social connections as well. Learning index. The fourth index here. I think we're on number four. The learning index here. You know, how smart is the community and how committed is it to lifelong learning opportunities and opportunities to plug into all types of learning? And this includes online learning. you know, how committed, how great are the libraries for continuing education programs, from yoga classes to cooking classes, to maybe more traditional academic classes. You know, how's the higher education opportunity? You know, these millennials in particular, because adulthood has been pushed back and because the jobs are so scarce, a lot of them we complain about are professional students right now. And they're looking, they're just going to stay in school because they can, you know, live on a loan and, you know, or live at home, you know, and wait for that job maybe, for the job market to open up again. So they're looking for those learning opportunities to plug in on all levels. This is something we hear a lot in communities from the next generation. They view learning opportunities and those connections as, you know, being able to have more opportunity to jump online as well. So this is a thing that we actually measure when we're working in a community. Is the Wi-Fi hotspots and how accessible making those connections are within a community. Around town, the fifth index here. You know, this is obviously getting around. How easy is it to get in and around town, as well as how easy is it to get out of town? Obviously, Dallas, the city of Dallas, the Dallas metro area, has definitely, you know, very easy access for people to access the world from Dallas. But, you know, internally, how easy is it to get in and around town? What do you hear about from your constituents out there? Are people wanting more bike lanes? Are people wanting more opportunities to get out of their cars, look for less, you know, car cities that are not so car dependent? This is something the next generation is definitely looking for because they, a lot of them, they can't afford to own a car. They see gas prices soaring, or they simply can't afford, you know, the monthly payment. And so they're looking to plug into those alternative modes of transit. A lot of them work within a mile or two of their house, and they would definitely want to commute by bike if that bike commute, bike, you know, that bike infrastructure was more in place. So how well does Dallas live up in that sense and matching those values from the next generation? This is from Bike Magazine, a map of the best cities for biking that they rate. And in Texas right now, there's only Austin has been identified as a great city to bike in. Portland is actually the number one new city to bike in, and Madison is has set their eyes on Portland to beat them there. In Madison, which is where our home office is, but as Mary mentioned, I work remotely and live in Illinois. But in Madison, I've been up there, and you know they get a lot of snow. You know, an average 90 to 100 inches per season, and their bike lanes are, this might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but their bike lanes are, and bike paths get snowplowed sometimes before the side streets. Because people, I've seen the crazy people up there in Madison, and they are commuting even when it's, you know, 20 degrees out or 0 degrees out and snow on the ground. They're still commuting by their bike. The other thing that comes into play with the around town part of things is the walkability of your community. And this gets back to that craving for social connections, craving for those more back to the neighborhood feel of things. And when you think of the word neighborhood and the definition for neighborhood, it really started out as Webster's Dictionary actually gets around the fact that it was a place you could go and run your errands. You could, you know, everything was in like an arm's reach for yourself. So how do neighborhoods, you know, look like in Dallas? What's the walkability of Dallas? And I actually if you go to walkscore.com, you can plug in any address in the city and get a sense for how walkscore scores the walkability of Dallas's neighborhoods. And this is just the downtown neighborhood. I just typed in Dallas, Texas, and so it pulls up the central location there. And it gave Dallas a score of 74 out of 100 as very walkable. To give you some comparison, Washington, D.C., for instance, is a 100 out of 100. That's a very walkable city. And so, you know, it's obviously not spread out the District of Columbia there. So this is something that I would encourage you to do. Plug in, in your district, you know, plug in addresses in your neighborhood that you represent and see what's the walkability of those. And think about, you know, how, what are all the attributes, the quality of life attributes available in your community, and how could those be expanded to make you, your district a more neighborhood feel. The last index to touch on is social capital. And next generation puts high value on those connections. Absolutely. You know, they want to, this is a next generation that grew up with a lot of multiculturalism. You know, they grew up in schools where there is much inclusivity. There's been a lot of inclusivity with this next generation. They want to connect to people. So they want to be in cities where they feel like there's opportunity to connect with all types of people with all different types of lifestyles. It goes also beyond the lifestyle side of things and making connections with different people. They want to live in a community where they feel like their voice is heard, like they are represented. We hear this a lot in communities where, you know, they wish there was more opportunities for them to plug in with city leaders, to maybe boards and commissions within the city. And, you know, my response is this to the next generation, because coming from a person who, you know, I'm 37 again, I'm very active in my community. My husband and I have decided to really devote kind of ourselves to community service in many ways. And it really comes down to, I often tell the next generation, stop just talking about that and saying you want a seat at the table. Do something about it. And it goes both ways. We should be thinking of this handoff and creating a stronger voice for all of our people like a baton race. You know, how can the older, more established leaders do a better job of passing that baton? And how can younger, more emerging leaders do a better job of giving the established leaders a better target to be able to hand that baton off to? That's how we should be thinking about this leadership gap within our communities, this social capital gap that we've seen amongst the generations between established and emerging leaders. Another thing we hear from the next generation around social capital is around this effort of, you know, how do I plug in to the networks within a community? How will I find people with similar interests that I have? They want to make connections outside of work. And in our research, we've have shown that communities that young professionals are 2 to 3 times more likely to stay in a community if they do indeed make connections outside of their work environment. Those connections outside of work are definitely important, as well as those connections inside of work with this next generation. They're looking to also work in companies that allow them to create a tribe, that allow them to work with people they like to work with. I'm sorry, that was not our last index. This is our last index, the after-hours index. Getting to the fun of the region. You know, this is the live first, work second demographic. This is the live first, work second mentality. And it's not just a mentality, really, for the next generation anymore. It's the mentality of many empty nester baby boomers as well, you know, who are wanting to get more active now that their kids, you know, hopefully might be out of the house if they're not hanging on by a thread there. You know, when we work in communities and talk to the next generation, you know, they talk so excited, you know, they're so enthusiastic about their after-hours opportunities. You know, they enjoy the festivals that they can get to in the summer months or in communities maybe that have great weather year-round. And, you know, they want different types of opportunities to plug into, from the arts and the culture to, you know, the bar scene, as well as to even, you know, the coffee shop scene. One of the biggest complaints we hear about from next generations, particularly in smaller communities, is if I want to meet new people or connect with people, I have to go to a bar. And not everybody wants to make those connections in a bar. They're seeking more opportunities, looking for those independent, authentic places to connect with people as well that may not be within that traditional nightlife scene. Another thing we hear about that you should think about in terms of Dallas is how well promoted are the things to do within this community. How easily can people find all the great fun attractions that there are in Dallas? Is it easily promoted? Sometimes when you think about your quality of life, it's not that you don't have it, it's that it's underutilized in many ways because it's not promoted very well. And, you know, when I say promoted, you have to think about the preferred information sharing, the technology that this next generation prefers to get their information from. And it's maybe not traditional websites. You know, they're looking for mobile apps, Yelp, Urban Spoon, those types of things to find out and look for those reviews of great restaurants to eat at. So in terms of that after hours index, you need to look at that. You know, do you have all those great amenities? Where are we missing some of, where are we missing, you know, some of those the amenities? Are we missing some cultural opportunities there? And how well connected and promoted are those opportunities to the next generation and all people living in Dallas? When we talk with the next generation, we ask them to let us, you know, how do you value these seven indexes? What would you rank these? Cost of lifestyle in the recent few years has ranked as number one, followed by the earning opportunities. Obviously that makes a lot of sense because of today's economy. Back when we were first doing our research with Generation X, social capital was actually the top ranked index. We've seen a major shift and a lot, absolutely back to that, that turning, that generational, that societal shift that we've seen has caused a shift in our rankings as well. So we asked the generation, how do you value these? Most important, very important, etc. And then we asked them, how do you perceive your city to be doing? And more often than not, we see gaps. We see gaps. The biggest gap typically is in that earning index. Makes sense with today's economy, absolutely. But you see, you know, gaps in the after hours, social capital, around town, etc. Typically, if there's a gap of more than a negative 15% variance, there's some issues there. And it might be perception issues. It may not be reality. They might be scoring great on terms of paper, in terms of what the data shows about a city, but that perception from the next generation, they score low in. And people's perception is their own reality. So you should consider that in terms of your planning. So I told Mary that I would bring some scores for Dallas. When we work in a city, we typically go through a what we call a handprint process. And we handprint a city using about 40 to 45 different measures for a community. This is usually an in-depth, anywhere from 4 to 6 month project. But in 2009, we unveiled what we called our next city ranking. And this was rankings. We actually looked at 250 cities that had pocket, and this was city data, not metro data or MSA data. This is city level data. And we looked at 250 cities with populations over 100,000. And we took all their data, plug it into our metrics, our formula, and can score a city within each of those indexes on a scale of 0 to 10. The larger, this is a spider diagram, the larger the handprint is, the further out to the edges it goes, the better the handprint for a community. For Dallas, the city of Dallas in our next...
This is 50,000 people, what they think about Dallas.
No, this is our handprint. Yeah, thank you, Mayor. So our handprint is data-driven, not perception-driven. So this is...
No, it's just that. It's just 50,000 people.
This is not based on people's perception. This is based on statistical measures plugged into our metrics. You're thinking of this graph, which is survey related?
No, I'm just saying, where's your database from on this next map?
This is based from Dallas's census data.
Okay, so the census?
Different measures, such as one measure, you know, the percent of people in the community with bachelor's degrees goes into this.
Got
those
it.
Types of statistics.
Okay.
So, and that would fall into like the learning category.
After hours.
The per capita nightlife.
Okay.
Those types of measures go into this. Thank you for that question, for some clarification. So we took those measures and looked at 250 cities And here's how Dallas is looking compared to the next city's average of 5. And again, this is 2009 ranking. This was based on old census data. New census data wasn't available, obviously, when we released this. It was mainly based on data available from the American Fact Finders of the Community Survey from typically 2006 to 2008 data. So just keep that in mind. Then we grouped. We took that list of 250 cities and we broke it down by population size. We wanted to see how these cities of like demographics, like populations, rate and rank against each other. And so Dallas obviously falls into a population category, what we called as our super cities. And that was a population of 500,000 people or more in their city limits. Again, this is city limit data. And Dallas in 2009 ranked 26 out of the 34 cities that fell in that population category. And I want to just give you some comparison to how, you know, that's all and good with the next city average, but I want to show you some comparison because the fact is that you might look at this and be like, hey, man, I don't know, that doesn't seem like we're so good. You might want to challenge me on the data. You know, it might give you a sense of anxiety to see this. I want to show you Dallas in comparison to the city in your population category that ranked number one out of these 34, and that was San Francisco. You can see the scan print. San Francisco got a zero in cost of lifestyle. What this shows you, and you know, we would probably all agree San Francisco is a great place to live, or at least it pops up on, you know, those great place to live lists all the time, absolutely. But being a great place to live, being a next city for the next generation, doesn't mean you score great in every single category. You know, San Francisco is terrible, a high cost of living. And therefore, a lot of millennials, a lot of next geners have, you know, migrated out of that city, or they're choosing more tier two cities. Because they can't afford those major metropolitans anymore in many ways. You know, social capital, below the next city average in terms of social capital. So this gives you one perspective, and I brought one more perspective as well. A fellow city of yours in Texas that ranked number 6 out of 34 in your category. And this is Austin. You can see Austin, compared to San Francisco, has maybe a little bit more well-rounded handprint here. Now, they're in the national average, just like Dallas is in terms of around town. They're pretty close together in terms of cost of lifestyle. Dallas scores at the national average with earning, Austin a little bit, a few points higher than that. You're pretty close in terms of learning there. Austin, you know, even with, you know, the university there, they still score below the next city's average because they're obviously being compared to these other major cities. And what surprises me most about this index is they only score a 5 in after hours. You know, Austin is looked to as, you know, a place for vibrant after-hours scenes.
Explain how that data, that number.
So for after-hours specifically, it's a per capita measure. So based, and we look at, for instance, the number of arts entertainment venues based on census available data per capita. It's broken into each index is broken into about 6 or 7 different measures. And in after hours, we're looking at the arts and culture. We're looking at the number of restaurants, full service restaurants in the community. We're looking at drinking establishments in a community. So those are some of the measures that go into an after hours. In
terms of per capita.
So it gives you because it's not fair to obviously when one community, you know, Dallas being, 1.2 compared to Austin, less than that. So we do pull the data on a per capita basis. In terms of earning, we're looking at the industry diversity. We're looking at the entrepreneur rate. Sometimes we actually let the cities, when we work within a city, we give you a menu of lists when we work with the city, and so these can be adapted. But for this next city's list, we kept them obviously all the same. for the learning, we look at Wi-Fi hotspots, we look at the educated population, we look at the college university availability on a per capita basis as well. For around town, we're looking at the commute time. We're looking at the walkability of a community. We're looking at airport activities. Those are some of the things. Again, this is a very data-driven measure. Whereas that graph that I showed you, that value versus perception, is all perception-driven. That's what the next generation says. The handprint is what the data actually says based on our methodology. So I wanted to just share this with you. Again, this is old data, but again, hopefully it will be helpful as you move into your planning phase here. And so when you think about, what does all this mean? What does the trends that I've shared, what does everything mean when it comes to planning? And you need to consider, obviously, the characteristics of your next citizens when you're doing any type of strategic planning. You need to think about those trends that I shared, from the America's winter, to those changing demographics, the aging and the diversifying of America there, to the social media trend and the localization, that localized movement that's coming more and more with this next generation, to that urbanization, to our cities are getting larger, which is where more of the economic output is happening in our larger cities, to the talent dividend. How can you, again, bring more educational attainment to your current citizens? To finally, how all of that wraps into quality of life as well. Another thing to consider is, the voice of the next generation, and is it represented? What does Dallas's next generation have to say? Are they involved? Where is the input level there? And they might be, absolutely. I don't have that answer, but you do. So ask yourself that question while you're planning. And as you move forward, think about how social change can occur. And where change can happen, where you might have the greatest impact in terms of change. What types of policies maybe the U.S. city and elected officials, what type of policies need to be addressed that can make Dallas a more attractive place for the next generation, have a more vibrant, maybe fun quality of life for them to be plugged into? What are those policies that need to be changed? An example might be, and you probably have this, but some cities don't actually, the open-air dining. That was actually one of those things that, I hope I didn't hit a tour star. I heard a couple. Example of a policy change around an actual index there. Think about what you can do as elected officials to help shift the attitude and behaviors of your constituents. Again, that handprint said one thing. Maybe your citizens say another thing. How can you bridge the gap more? How can you get perception and, their reality, their perception, to really match the reality of Dallas a little bit better? So how can you change their attitude and behaviors? How can you get them more engaged? How can you get them out enjoying the quality of life that's currently here and more engaged in helping develop that? And, how can you embrace the social networks of people? How can you embrace these, this growing social graph of individuals where they are looking to connect to help you in that effort? And most importantly, think about, as you move into your planning process, how you can capitalize and build on your distinctiveness. Where are you, your authenticity? How can you build and capitalize on that? And I want to leave you with one more video. And this is called The Fairy Godmother. And what it is it's actually a video that came out of a campaign that was done for the state of Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania started to see a big out-migration of the next generation, a big out-migration of young talent to the East and West Coast. And they kept saying, why are we losing all this young talent? We need to find a way to show our uniqueness, show where we are distinctive, our own distinctiveness, and sell it better to the next generation. We need to capitalize on it and build those assets So they are more known, and we become more attractive to the next generation. And they started this Stay in Bent PA campaign, actually. And, they started this campaign, you know, the Stay in Bent PA campaign, where that's exactly what they did. They were highlighting all the great attributes and how this maybe differs from the coast cities, trying to get people to stay here. So I leave you with this video and that thought. How can you capitalize on Dallas's uniqueness, its assets, and its distinctiveness? Here's the fairy godmother.
I'm your fairy godmother!
So, you're taking that job out west, huh?
Come here. Come here. Are you nuts? Come on!
This is what you can afford out west!
Look at this!
This is what you can afford here.
Good, huh? Double time!
Check out Pennsylvania at InventPA.com.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
You
know
that?
No! Earthquake!
What's the main component of that video?
Quality of life.
That's what they're selling with that. At the very end, they kind of trickle in there all the diverse industries they have going. But they focused on quality of life and selling that to the next generation. And that's really where it is when it comes to being a city that's more adaptive, more attractive for the next generation, this millennial demographic. Thanks for being such great listeners. I hope you found this valuable. And
Molly, thank you. Quick instructions and kind of logistics. The restrooms are by the door as you go out. Right side going out for men, left side going out for women. And our host is Mary Grinder. I want to take just a few minutes of your time to welcome you and talk to you about where we are. And then we'll take a few minutes right after that. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's fine. Oh, we're going to ask questions? Could we?
Yeah, sure. But let's
Mary,
on our way. She's been waiting
up. Sure. Go ahead. Yeah, please.
Well, I'll be so bad. That's Claire. We're so grateful to have you here. Anytime that we can have a wonderful city council in the Dallas Arboretum, which we're so proud to be on the city of Dallas Department, which is great. As you know, we're in autumn at the Arboretum. If you have a chance, we want you to see the garden. If you have a chance to walk 41 steps, you can see the new Yankee Rustic Red Maple Rail. A lot of people don't even know what that means. A rail is a brook or a stream. This is lined with 200 Japanese red maple trees that will change colors twice a year. They haven't changed color yet, and it's extraordinary, so it's going to be growth right now. A lot of people don't know that when they say, could this be a world-class garden, that we are a world-class garden. MSN, last year, named us one of the top 14 things you need to see in the world in the spring, where there were good sharp gardens. And you, all the major gardens in the world, and we're one of them, right here in Dallas, Texas. A lot of people don't know that during autumn, we sell more tickets than we do to Dallas Place. This is an extraordinary place. We want you to spread the word for us. A lot of times when you talk about the quality of the city, the heartbeat of the city, the soul of the city, you're going to see it here when you walk around. There's a beautiful diversity of this garden. And come anytime, which is so happy to have. Down the road, please help me remember three things. I can help raise money for great dreams. People won't pay for parking or bathrooms or roofs. So when I come and I say, please remember me, I hate to always be talking about stalls, bathroom stalls, parking stalls, whatever. I always thought my life was going to be a little bit different. But that's what I mean. So, keep me in mind, because those are prime human needs for us. Our attendance was 620,000 last year, and 68,000 more than that right now, for the summer in which nobody came. Right next year, I'm going to be announcing a note to have stronger that will boost our attendance far more than that next year. Following that, I've got a children's garden that will boost it even more. So I'm going to need a lot of help. Thank you for your attention.
Why don't we open up for questions that people might have had?
You know, you talked about the fall, winter, spring, and summer, and you also talked about an ethnic shift in the city of Dallas. How do you connect the ethnic shift to the fall, winter, spring, and summer that is, you know, it's, I think the ethnic, I don't know how you connect that, because the ethnic shift may not be fall, winter, summer, and spring like people in this room do. You know, the ethnic shift has a whole different need and capacity, and maybe it's not so different as I think about it, but I think, you know, when you're talking about, you know, levels of income, you're talking about those types of diverse things that happen with an ethnic shift.
That's a great question, and I wish I had, you know, a perfect thought out answer for you. And I would like to actually give that some more thought and get back to you on that in many ways. But one good thing I see kind of initially, unfortunately, and I start by saying unfortunately, you know, a lot of you know, the diversity in this country, you know, class does unfortunately come into play with it in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at those social systems within our country, and the people who are tapping into that, you know, and have a need to tap into those. And so you can, you know, thinking about those seasons that I talked about, and, you know, spring being a time where those social systems are, kind of born and they come out and they're working very well through spring and summer. And then fall, they, you know, you start to see some maybe deterioration of them. And winter, they really just kind of start to fall apart in many ways for many people. And so I can see a connection in, I don't know if that's the connection that maybe that your question is going there. But I do see some of a connection where you can, you know, plug in terms of how the seasons are impacting, the people of different races and ethnicity, in particular with our social systems. And in many ways, again, being that, social, the class does come into play, with ethnicity in many ways. And, the fact is that in history, you know, people, you know, of minority, diverse backgrounds, sometimes have to, you know, they're the ones utilizing some of those social systems more so than people than white people, for instance. So you can see some of connection there, but I would really like to be able to give that some more thought and bounce that even off my team back at the office and give you guys some more perspective on that.
Do you have a diverse team?
You know, that's a great question, and I can tell you in terms of race and ethnicity, we are not diverse. In terms of lifestyle, we are diverse. We are a woman-owned firm, and we are a lesbian-gay women-owned firm.
With the X generation, and I was looking at Channel 13, and they did the X generation. Do you see, and I can consider myself somewhat in the X generation, but not in the X generation, because I think things move too slow. You know, do you find that happens with the X generation? You know, it's like I want things to speed up. to rush. And one of the things I really want to ask is this, with the X generation, how do you see elected officials that who are in their late 50s and 60s and 70s
just say baby boomers.
baby boomers
that opened up the diversity and the culture.
Well, you know, how do you see when they bring on young, or try to train young council members? Because, you know, I have individuals who are perhaps younger than me who may be interested in running for city council, but I fear because they don't know some things about housing, some things about finance, some things about law, some things about certain things, and you don't want to discourage them not to run, but they might not, you know.
Right, they might use it. That's a very interesting question. You asked several questions in there. The first one being around that, you know, with Generation X and, you know, wanting things done quickly, maybe, you know, going at things a little more quickly than the boomer generation. I heard that question in there. And, you know, some of it is boomers love to, from the generational characteristic perspective, you know, boomers bring a very keen, inclusive decision-making process to the table. And that fits well with the millennials' characteristics. They're looking for a very keen, inclusive decision-making process as well. The problem is that you have this Gen Xers in the middle there who tend to look for quicker ways to solve problems and do it more independently. So you have some of that conflict in how we all solve problems. And so, you know, Gen Xers will look at boomers and millennials slowing down the process, whereas boomers and millennials might look at Gen Xers as, you know what, you're speeding through this too much and not bringing in a large enough voice because you're taking it on in too independently of a way. The other question around, you know, how do you bridge that gap, that knowledge gap, with established leaders and emerging leaders? And, you know, that's another element of where our systems are broken in many ways. We need to find ways to help mentor and really, you know, give the knowledge to our future leaders. But the other thing you have to remember here is, how did you all learn that? A lot of you weren't educated on those issues. You learned on the job. You learned, you know, as you got in there. Maybe you had a general sense and general knowledge based on maybe the industry you work in or, you know, your lifestyle, absolutely. But, you know, so much of it, we have to forget that there's a lot of established leaders who are afraid to bring a younger voice or mentor younger people because, or, you know, give them a seat at the table because they say that very thing, you know, they don't have the knowledge. But if you don't give them a seat at the table, they're never going to learn the knowledge. So, one, think of that, and two, think about what systems, how can, you know, programs be established, more mentoring be occurring to help those people along. Yeah.
The survey that you did, you know, you ranked jobs from 26 out of 34 cities, and you got 7 different categories. The reason why Dallas was ranked so low, probably because of the universities and the colleges that in those cities, because Capital Park, Austin, Texas, and UT got to the Dallas from Fulton there, but do that make a difference in learning and the cultural lifestyle?
It absolutely does play into account for that lower learning score. Is that your question?
Yeah, learning score, but also overall.
Overall, does the what do you mean overall?
Overall, okay. If you compare Houston, Texas, San Francisco, you know, they have more than one college there.
Yes, because on a per capita basis, they're going to score higher in that sense because they have more than one college than maybe Dallas would because they have only one, for instance. Unfortunately, I don't have the specific measures in front of me here, but on a specific measure side of things, it's all based on a number on a per capita basis. So if Houston has more And let's say, just for argument's sake, let's say Houston and Dallas are the exact same population size. And Houston has three colleges and universities in that census data category, but Dallas only has one. Houston's going to have a higher score in that category, that particular measurement, than Dallas on a per capita basis because they have more, you know, that measure against it. Does that explain?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And yeah, I will share. Again, these are old data points, but I will go. I will get that to Mary to share. Yes.
Ask the questions, please, Mayor.
Yes.
One, if your presentation as to how people connect.
Yeah.
I did not see a description to show how people connect based on their cultural background. I saw in there you had people connecting by going to bars or going to coffee hours. African Americans connect by going to church. I didn't see that in there. Is that because that's not something you talk about, or is it because it's something I should be thinking about? Or
no, it's absolutely something you should be thinking about. It's just something that we haven't looked at. We haven't looked at in our research. Our current data points. We haven't looked at that. We haven't broke down the next generation by race and ethnicity.
Okay.
We just haven't done it. Not to say we shouldn't. You know, that's an absolute good point to make. But yeah, here, we just haven't done it. But absolutely, you should be looking at that.
My second question. You talked about talent driven men, and you talked about how education makes a difference. That is a difficult statement for me to make to the general public, because the next question is, why make a difference? Help me with that answer. Help me to explain what you had on that slide in general public language.
Well, that is research from CEOs for Cities, and in its most basic form, that the underlying theme around that is people who are more educated tend to make more money. That's where that comes from.
Why?
Unfortunately, I don't necessarily. Why? Because they get better jobs. They have higher paying jobs. That's what it comes down to. They're in more of the knowledge based sector, and the knowledge based sector is those jobs that require the degrees, maybe more different types of problem solving, so to speak. Are different from the service sector that tend to be lower paying wages. So people who have degrees, just because they're in those higher paying jobs, they make more money, and that's the argument that's behind that research. It's not our research, but it's CEOs for Cities, and that's their underlying theme behind the talent dividend.
I'll read you two more questions here. Dwayne had one in
second. Yeah. Molly, when you were doing your index on number 5, you're around town,
mm-hmm.
James Blazer by walkability. You said all I did was put this figure in. Is there a place to go on the...
Oh, the walk score?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Check your walk score in your neighborhood.
Yep.
Because you sugar this.
It's walkscore.com.
And that'll give us...
Yep, go to walkscore.com. There will be a field for you to simply put in your address anywhere in the city, and it will pull up your walk score.
Okay,
and
then what about the bike?
The bikeability, that map was issued by Biking Magazine, and they put out, they rate cities based on the bikeability, and they're typically looking at the number of bike lanes, maybe the miles and the number of bike lanes. They're looking at the trail activity, how many trails, the miles of trails in the community.
I think that's region.
I unfortunately don't know the answer to that, but I have a feeling it's probably an MSA level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So I had one last question. It's really a perception I've got, and I want you to opine on it. You know, this notion that the kids, and I actually think this is, I think there's two classes going on here. There's folks that are wealthier,
and a lot of the things you're talking about there, and then there's folks that aren't as wealthy, and there's high pregnancy at 18 and stuff like that. You're growing up real fast,
sure.
Okay? But let's talk about that first group. My sense, and I mean, this may be really terrible with me saying this, but I just feel that they're not as industrious and they don't work as hard. And you said a few things that seem to corroborate that what was the term, live first, work second, you know. And there seems to be a cultural thing because I was brought up, you work first and play later. Is that endemic and misjudging that, or is there a whole attitude about industry with this group that hangs around their mom's house forever?
Yeah, it's a fair perception it's a fair question to definitely ask. And, you know, I think you have to, though, determine how do you define working hard. And, you know, the next generation, you know, they, and you know, when, and in terms of the next generation of knowledge workers that you preference that statement around, you know, they're looking for ways to work smarter, to have more life-work balance, for more flexibility in when and where the work gets done.
Maybe my question is pure hours. Is this group working as many hours as the previous generation?
No. Not as boomers. Boomers were workaholics. Yeah. So, you know, boomers hung their hat, and, you know, this is a general characteristic but boomers, they put their work ethic right on their work ethic. And it's very different for the next generation.
And how about the X's? Okay.
The Gen Xers?
Did it slide down, or did it...
The Gen Xers are definitely workaholics themselves, but they're smarter workaholics. They're working...
They work as many hours.
They work... Gen Xers are currently 30 to 50 years old. Yeah. Boomers are 58 plus right now. And then millennials are 29 and younger. What's interesting is, you know, Xers, they don't maybe work quite as many hours as boomers, but I have to say this, that it doesn't mean that they're not as productive.
I know, that's a question for productivity.
Yeah. But in terms of hours, And millennials are looking really to they just want that average 40-hour work week. They feel if they can just really be in just the average full-time work week instead of, you know, the boomer average work week of maybe 60 hours, that will give them the balance that they're seeking. You know, in many ways, they're looking to make enough to be able to have the lifestyle that they want to have. You know, they haven't put achievement by how much you make, like many boomers did before them.
Hi, guys.
Yeah,
we're
like,
the technology skills, yeah.
And I was looking at the fact that the next generation of technology is going to take us out of the newspapers.
One question. With the new generation X, how do you see them in the workplace? Are they more student ties?
Well, Xers have been in the workplace. Generation X is 30 to 50. I think you're asking more about the millennials. You know, Xers brought definitely more of a casual, they wanted more casual workplaces, like jeans. Yeah, they were looking for more business casual. Boomers really introduced the business casual. Xers wanted more casual. And then millennials are definitely looking for a more casual environment. But again, you know, you have to remember that everyone is a little bit different, and they definitely bring in their own personality.
If we go into the younger generation, do jobs like the city of Dallas, do we need to start looking at a more environment where they can dress more casual and work?
You know, yes and no. I wouldn't put the casual. I'm sure they would value more things in a work environment than casual dress. You know, they're definitely going to be more of a business casual. They don't want to be showing up in suits and ties, for sure.
All right,
thank you, everyone.
Secretary, when she was governor of Arizona, on the issue of infrastructure,
which I'd like to change that language, and I'll explain that to you. Ed Rendell, as governor of Pennsylvania, and then later the Democratic National Committee, had me come in and do a project for him on investing in America. We met through Antonio Villaraigosa. Tim Kaine had me come and do a project for him for Southern Governors. And I know that it sounds strange because my reputation is someone who comes from right of center, but in reality, when I've done work for states and localities, it's almost exclusively for Democrats. So we are neither Republican or Democrat in this room. We're American in this room. And we put the priorities of the people ahead of partisanship. And it's one of the reasons why I've been able to do these projects all across the political spectrum, and frankly, not just across the country, but across the globe. I said to the man when I walked in here that this is the smallest project that will cause me the greatest amount of anxiety, because I'm nervous that you will see and feel and truly understand what people say when you're not in the room, what they really think, and more importantly, what they really feel. It's very hard, and I used to walk behind, I'll give you an example from a Republican mayor, Rudy Giuliani. I used to walk behind him in his parades, and I'd be about 10 or 12 feet behind, and they would all yell out and wave, "Hey, Rudy, Rudy," and he would wave back at them. And I can't use the language, so I don't want to insult anyone, but oh my God, when they got about 10 feet in front of him, what they would say behind his back. Horrible. At least half of you would be offended by the words that they would use. In essence, this is behind your back. This is reality. This is what they think, and this is how they feel. And I'll stop as we go through it, and anyone's got any questions or comments, let me know. One last point about methodology. You're probably going to want to take some notes. Is that we did the best that we could to match national questions. So not only is this an evaluation of how Dallas thinks and feels, the city of Dallas, not only is it an evaluation of how they think and feel, but it's meant to tie into where Dallas is across the country. I got a little bit of bad news for you, and I got a lot of good news for you, and I think that will help you with the direction going forward. The first thing is that if you are in government, just by the nature of your profession, people don't like you. You're here for public service, and many of you, probably most of you, could be making a lot more money not doing what you're doing right now. Oh, it's even in tune. And you know what? Nobody appreciates it. Nobody appreciates the effort and the stresses and strains. And it is worse in Washington. It is a little bit less bad on the state level. It is a little less bad on the local level. The fact is you're the most trusted level of government there is because you're closest to the people. That said, it still ain't great. So what they're asking of you is that they really do want you to stop with the politics. No Republicans, no Democrats, no liberals or conservatives. It's just us. And it's not even us and them, it's us together. And they're looking for real solutions, and your city is more focused on the future and more optimistic than anything that I told, maybe forever. And I'm going to show you that momentarily. They really do think that you're going to be better off next year and further down the road. They have a level of confidence, but in some ways they're sacrificing more than others in other cities. So it's a good picture, but it's still a mixed picture. And I want to set the tone for this presentation with the thing that we find in the work that I've done that is the most positive, which is a commitment, no matter how good things are, to make them better. No matter how difficult it is, to make a commitment to generational improvement, personal improvement, neighborhood improvement. This concept of belief in better is a concept that they want you to adopt because they don't believe in the status quo. They don't want what things are today, even if they're okay for some of them. They really want tomorrow to be better than today, and they want to have confidence again in the future. And this last part right here, you know what the use is? The number one way to demonstrate accountability, and as you will see, accountability is so much of what the constituents here want from you.
Why are people so angry? And they're angry across the country. It's because they think they were promised something that they didn't get. Either better schools, better job opportunities, a safer community. Whatever it was, the perception versus the reality, the expectation versus the reality, it's not living up to it. Now, if I'd mentioned when you first got elected, I would have said to you, hey, we got real problems here. I would have absolutely toned it down so the expectations are lower. One of the reasons why they resent government at all levels is that they think that you make promises to them that they cannot keep.
Are you talking in generalities right now? Are you talking about Dallas results that you got from
this? This is just setting the tone.
It's generality.
Yes, and one of the great challenges that you have is so few of you actually set the tone, set the expectations, which is what causes this great division. If they have an idea of what you will do and what you won't do, then they're not going to be disappointed. But on a federal, state, and local level, you'll see that the biggest criticisms they have, it's not even the economy, it's of the people who represent them. Again, all of us. And it is angry, and they are mad. So, first, nationwide, it's amazing to me that at the beginning of this year, 44% of Americans thought that the future for the country was going to be worse tomorrow, that our best days are behind us. Remember, we used to be the most optimistic nation and culture on the face of the globe. We had this belief that tomorrow was that much more powerful, that the little orphan Annie, the sun will come out tomorrow, in the middle of the Depression. And now we're evenly split. On Dallas, almost two-thirds think that Dallas, the city of Dallas, the conditions in Dallas, will be better tomorrow, that your best days are ahead of you. And only 15% of pessimists, that 4-to-1 ratio, when you consider what it is for America, is powerful. And it's distinctive. So again, I go back to the contest because it's so important. You have to show them, and you always have to be communicating. And there's a lot of communication language in here. Because I know that all governments have so little trust. And it's really important. By the way, what is this? Like an air conditioning? Is that what it is? I know I'm nervous, but I'm not this nervous. Wow. By the way, what a beautiful park. Cool. The guy offered to take me to drive me here, and I actually wanted to walk because he's just looking at all the plants. So this is the good news. I never knew this existed, by the way. Okay. I want to show, you know what? Before I show you what the data is, I want to show hands. How many of you overall are better off today than your parents were when they were your age? Overall, and I'll let you define it, who's better off than your parents? No, but we're not the Queen of England. You've got to go up or down. And who's worse off today than their parents? And who's exactly the same as their parents? Who's worse off? Why are you worse off?
Are you talking about the overall though? By the time my parents were my age, I didn't have a lot.
Why did you wish off?
I didn't. I was pointing to her. Oh. She had her hand up. I didn't think you saw her.
And is anyone else who's worse off? How many of you truly believe either that your kids or that the next generation, not that you want it to be, but you truly believe that they will be better off than you? When they get to be your age, and who think your kids will be worse, or the next generation will be worse off than you when they get to be your age. So what's your concern?
They still see the same opportunities around them. They're already, as they're growing up, they're not.
What's your concern?
I'm just saying that whether you get an opportunity or not, they have the culture trend is a lot different. The music, the videos, the things they're seeing.
And the thing is, it's also part of the culture of the country that we will pass along a better nation and that the kids will be better off than us. Maybe it's talk and maybe it was in literature, but we believed it, we bought into it, and here are the numbers. You have a 6-point difference. Overall, 70% say that their quality of life is better than their parents nationwide. 12% say it's worse. Among Dallas, the numbers are not as good, 64-26. So 1 out of 4 people do not believe that their quality of life is better than their parents. That's the bad news. Good news is nationwide, only 34% think their kids are going to be better off than them, 44% worse. Look at the numbers for Dallas. 57-28 in a positive way. So there's something happening here that is bothering them about right now. But there is a belief, a positive belief, that shows up in almost every bit of the data that says that whatever challenges you're facing today, you will address them and resolve them, and it's going to be better for them tomorrow. These are the 5 attributes that this is mastery. In fact, everyone stand up. Everyone stand up. We ask the public, those of you in the back now, to look around people. What are the 5 things that matter most? What are the 5 things that you want more of that you don't have enough of? The top 5 answers, fewer hassles, more choices, more money, more time, no worries. These came in the top 5. Now, let's split it up because there's a difference by gender, or there may be. How many of you think that men nationwide chose fewer hassles as their number 1 priority? Raise your hands. And the mayor goes down at the very beginning. If your hand was up, you need to sit down. You know, I did this at the mayor's presentation. Were you listening? Somebody take away his BlackBerry. Who said men chose more choices as their number 1? What they wanted more of? Nobody says choices. Who says money? Men chose money. Who says men chose more time? Raise your hands. All you time people, sit down. Who says men chose no worries as their highest priority? No, you guys need to sit down. Now, only the people still standing, and I want to make a point. Look at how many women are standing compared to men. And this is about men, and women know men better than men know men. We'll have to ask who the mayor actually knows. What is the highest priority among American women? Who says more money? Raise your hands. No one. Who says fewer hassles? No one. Who says more choices? No. Who says no worries? No. The people still standing, and only one guy. Women correctly identified that women want time.
You can't hear me.
So who has no wife to say
that? Okay, well, so just, I mean, of course you can't hear me over the shirt that he's wearing. The people standing correctly identified that women want time and men want money. So congratulations to those people. Now, if you're taking notes, this is not policy and this is not rocket science. What are you doing? Who's been in city government for more than 10 years here? Raise your hands. Who's been for more than 15 years? 20 years? Oh my God. 25 years. Okay, I'm going to ask the 3 of you, how does city government provide your constituents fewer hassles? Every one of you should be able to answer that question. Honestly, if you've been in city government for 25 years and you can't do that, you're the next guy, but I'm not giving you fewer hassles. I'm going to ask you, how do you provide no worries? How do you provide no worries?
Fewer worries, we provide better services.
The
other community.
Hey, wait a minute.
You're right there.
By the way, Sorry. She reminds me of Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. You just said Safer City. How would you really, if you really want people not only to respect what you've done, but to appreciate it and feel it? No mom should be afraid when her child goes out to play that something will go wrong. No father should have to walk 3 miles to a park to play catch with his son. No grandparent should have to constantly look behind them. Please, personalize it. This is not BS language. This is real. We are afraid. And there's something good about what's happening here, but I want you to remove that fear. By the way, you're going to see that you have an issue with safety here that's worse in the country. I will get to that. Okay, well, how does what city government does, how do you provide more choices?
Culture.
Not her. She's the other 25-year person.
We would need culture.
Okay, what about culture?
Park. We had more choices. We put more choices. We're adding more parks.
Retail.
We have lots of retail choices, lots of food choices.
Okay, then what I want you to do here is, for those who love outside, for those who love to walk, there are more paths in more parks than ever before. But the problem with that is that that's a statistic rather than a feeling. For those who enjoy jogging, there are more jogging paths. For those who like to ride bicycles, for those who love the theater, we now have this. For those who love sports, we have this. We always put it in that perspective. For those who want, for those who love, we put it from the perspective of the constituent rather than what you offer. That's how you demonstrate that you've got more of it. These are your 5 attributes. For those of you taking notes, these are the things that matter most. Please connect to them on those levels. So now, the economy.
So for 15 days,
we
get a copy of this presentation.
Yes. But you should still be writing notes. Get a pen. You're one of the youngest people here. I hope you're not. I don't know any better. My only hope is that I get to the airport safely.
We have great people.
A year ago, yes, but I've done this in southern towns, and I've always wondered when they're coming up behind me, whether it's one of those movies from the 1950s where I ain't making it to the airport.
Oh, man.
Now, a year from today, what will the economy be? Nationwide, 52-27, it's going to be worse. The American people believe that the worst days are still ahead economically. Dallas, 45-17, better. The good news in that is that they're optimistic. And they behave, when they're optimistic, they behave in a better way. They're more likely to invest. They're more likely to hire. They're more likely to do more. Here's the bad news. If it isn't better a year from now, you've got that expectations problem. 5 years from now, the American people think the economy is better by 53-20. In Dallas, 61-12. You don't have pessimists here. It's not that everyone's an optimist, but there isn't that pessimism that you get in other parts of the country. There isn't that negativity that you will find in other cities. However, I said to you there's some differences. 30% of Americans think that have at least some concern that they could lose their jobs. It is identical in Dallas. So even though they are hopeful, almost 1 in 3 are at least somewhat concerned that they could be unemployed. And based on your comment, I would raise that to 2 out of 3. Okay, that would be gold. Here's one of the negatives for you. Has your situation, has your economic situation caused you to change your behavior? Nationwide, it's now 54%. This is a Gallup survey. We tried to replicate this stuff as close as possible. In Dallas, it's even higher. Now, what that means is they're not taking a vacation, or they're not spending on a new car, or they're not buying a major appliance. That's not good, because that holds back consumption. Maybe they're saving.
But could it be that they're more fiscally conservative too?
Yes. Yes. And yes.
Well, I think here.
Oh, about Vietnam. I don't know. I've never known. Never known Texas to be afraid of much. So what are they looking for in terms of the future? Nationwide, it's stability. In Dallas, stability and opportunity are dead even. In fact, it used to be that opportunity was number one, but things are so bad across America. And I can't emphasize that enough. Just how negative and fearful and divided and angry and anxious and annoyed the public is. Not here. You got your two attributes, stability and opportunity. And once again, that plays into this commitment to the future. If they're looking for the chance to do better, they want to do better next year. And this is something that I challenge you all. Who does economics? Who specifically focused on economics here? Anyone? It isn't jobs that they're looking for. A job is 9 to 5. By the way, we did this nationwide and the numbers are much more narrow. A job is something you dread. A job you don't want to get up for.
That's right.
A job means you're looking for another one. A career, which is what most of you probably have here. A career is something you take with you for year after year. A career is something else. Why are we promising or talking about jobs when your constituents want something more out of their lives and out of their future?
So they want more skills?
They want more skills. Well, that's where it goes into the opportunity. They want more skills, and they insist on that from education. They want something that is more challenging. They want something that they can connect to, where they are appreciated. By the way, one of the great words for this is that they are respected. A job, you just have cash. A career, you have respect. Yes, ma'am.
So are you suggesting that the president would have gotten better reception by calling his package a career bill as opposed to a jobs bill?
I have to ask the mayor. I said I would not do anything in politics. I don't know
you. Let's go to the next slide.
I never got the question.
But I... Next slide.
Okay. Wow. And this is the overarching aspect. And I don't know if any of you do this. Do any of you specifically focus on public health in this room?
Not as much because that's a county job.
But here's what's amazing. This is not about health care. This is about healthy schools. This is about healthy communities, healthy neighborhoods, a healthy economy.
The quality of life.
Would
it go under the quality of life?
Yes. Because healthy means that it's expanding. Healthy means that there isn't those pathologies that we're trying to avoid in the community that so many cities have. We did not know this until about a year ago, and it came up so strong. And once again, this is a way to communicate that your constituents want to hear from you. This gets out of the partisanship, gets out of the ideology, gets out of the ethnic and racial and age divisions in this country. A healthy community transcends all the traditional barriers. So what do they want from you guys in terms of governance? I should have asked you guys this question before I pulled it up. I'll let you just take a look at it, because I think it says it all. I know that often if there are divisions, it's not where you're located. It's not your voters if you're elected into here. And it's not even the forgotten. There's something about the population which is increasingly rare and very frightening to pollsters like me, which is that we are more and more often identifying ourselves by smaller and smaller groups, and we are less and less tolerant of each other. The Tea Party on one side, the Wall Street protests on the other, the divisions that you all know so well in this city, they're telling you, they're screaming to you universally, represent all of us. Don't fall into those divisions that cause us to pull apart. out of the stock for a minute, just in case any of you want to ask about this, talk to each other about it.
I mean, obviously, one of the issues that's right underneath the surface of Dallas is race. So I assume this is, represents the different ethnic groups?
There was no difference in race in answer to this question.
Okay.
There's no difference in income. There's no difference in gender. There are differences in some of these issues. And there's differences in expectation. I'll tell you right now, the white community is much less optimistic about the future than either the African American community or the Hispanic community. So there are differences in race. But there is no difference in the answer to this question. So what do they want most? Even about failing schools that don't prepare students, politicians who put politics before solving the problems, they blame politicians more than anything else for the challenges. And this is an awful thing that I have to present. And this is the thing that you will debate and probably argue about after I leave. But this doesn't surprise me, because, by the way, the national perception of Dallas, irrelevant. Even a lobbyist and a special interest, anything that's down here doesn't matter. The two things that matter, the politicians, and that doesn't just mean the elected people, it means the whole government and the schools that fail to prepare, which is a comment that one of you made before. If those schools continue to fail, that optimism will turn into pessimism. Yes. If we just said the economic recovery, they would have looked at that as a national. But we put that as a Dallas economic recovery. To them, it's everybody.
So it might be national politicians.
Yes.
And the local politicians.
But I'm not going to use that as a way to let you guys off the hook.
But
that's
still
thinking it's just politicians. Because as I said, in San Jose, we get blamed for the high weeds on the freeways, which is a state problem, but they look at all of the domestic officials.
Yes.
So they kicked off with politicians, period.
They have no idea. They have no idea who fixes what. But they assume that when something goes wrong, and if they get you in a corner somewhere, they're going to blame you. Exactly, which means they see you more and they can complain more. Okay. So what are they looking for? Here's the bad news that are kicking the ass comes in at 19%. The thing that matters most to me, it's these three. Accountable. And I'm going to say something to you specifically, because I know that in this form of government, you frankly have less control. That is the definition, both nationwide and locally, that will determine your success. Your approval is whether you hold yourself and the people around you accountable. I don't want to jump you. I actually want to help you so that a year from now, when you gather again in this beautiful place, you'll be one step ahead. Accountability they think is missing from politics, and they don't think that you listen. This one here, balance short-term objectives for long-term steady growth, doesn't matter nearly as much nationally as it does here. Why is it? I'm going to stop and ask you a question. Why would Dallas consistently be so focused on the future, so much more so than the nation overall? Someone teach me.
I think it's because we're a younger city and people know that there's a lot of big road in front of us. You know, they don't know if it's all going to be perfect or it's going to be bumpy, but it's not like we're Detroit or a city that, or even Chicago, which is like, you may have seen its best days, it's going to try to get there, but it's a young city. We're like 19 years old. And,
We haven't been hit by recessions and things like that in a big way like other cities have. So, but we believe that's why we have not had the huge, you know, impact that some of what California has. So I think that's part of the optimism.
Go ahead.
I believe that there's really there's been a tradition, a history in this country, and it goes back 60, 70 years about doing things that have really been forward thinking, pushing this whole area that is really just it was here. It's something that got started, and it's in the price point. Going back to the Zappium.
Can't do that, and
you can see it almost in a way, the vibrancy out of the people that are business oriented, they accept people from the outside quickly, they look to the ideas that are not concerned as much about where they're coming from, but are they good ideas, and part of the culture. And that's what I think you're thinking.
And we're seeing it as not a pretty road we can step out on the limb. If you look at our art district, really where we're on today, you look at the Texas Rangers, you know, from St. Louis tonight, you look at the Cowboys, look at our stadium, Jerry Jones, and the forefront, it's just very daring. And as the mayor said, we are hard as we can, and we can do it here.
Si se puede.
Yeah.
That's the only Spanish I can say.
Hola.
A lot of us are many Dallas sites, many Texans, and especially DNA.
I went everything up to the can-do spirit, and yes, we can. I'm not convinced that the swagger is as universally appreciated as the optimist. Am I wrong?
I'm sorry, you mean in Dallas or outside Dallas?
Outside Dallas.
No, even in Dallas. I think that based on what I've seen here, give them a reason. You have to give them a reason for the swagger. You can't just say, hey, tomorrow's going to be better than today. You're going to have to show them evidence, show them proof. Let them see that these changes are happening the right way for them to accept it. And outside Dallas, I will tell you that the swagger does not play well.
Yeah.
I think along with what AC said, even back in the early 60s, I remember a little girl, and we had Love Field, and people had these bowls for Dallas on the DFW, like, what in the heck are we doing an international airport in the middle of nowhere? And all of a sudden, that is our economic engine for not only the city, but for our whole region. Where would we be if people, you know, didn't want to widen the Midwest Expressway? Where would we be if we didn't have, you know, this in and out going through Dallas? So I think it is that forward thinking, that long-term steady growth, that people remember these things, and they're like, where would we be if we didn't have these people that were thinking about the future?
But you charged me $12 just to get out of the airport.
It's
the single most expensive, and I go to every city in America. I don't get out of the airport until the meters got up to $12. So I don't know who put that in. Did Jesus Dallas benefit from that?
Our airport.
We own 70%.
Okay. Okay, so then I expect to get $7 with my trip back.
That's what we're charging more with wood.
What Pauline said, I think it's correct. We have these big ideas, but I'm not sure Jerry's wrong about the swagger. The big ideas are supported by the swagger. We have a big idea, and we say, we can do a big old airport because we're Texas. We're Dallas. And that's the swagger. That's what I think is underneath what Colin said about why we can do big ideas.
Well, whatever it is, it's great. Because it's doing very well for the city at a time when every place else in America is feeling really, really awful. Now, in terms of the budget, the difference here, nobody wants increases in taxes alone. You've got 40% of your residents that just want to cut spending. The biggest, but it's only a plurality, say it's a combination of the two. Nationwide, by the way, even among Republicans nationwide, people want a combination of cutting spending and increasing taxes. But understand that it's just about tax increases. The public absolutely says no. And in terms of what the highest priority is, this is going to be a little controversial, but you need to know. The lowest, and here's what's interesting, the lowest percentage are cops, so you have to make a priority. The lowest percentage is senior citizens and retirees, and yet, nobody wants to cut anything from them. For senior citizens and retirees, they want exactly as it is today. The highest percentage isn't children, youth, and students, it's job creators and small businesses. It's economic, even more than young people. And that does stand out to me. That is pretty significant. Now let me flip, yes.
I have a question, and it is just following me. I believe that you, it's just my belief, you have better cities when you have inner city neighborhoods, which is poor neighborhoods, and helping with the homeless. It's almost as if this survey was done on wealth. Surely you didn't go into poor pockets to get this type of survey, because it would have been a different type of survey.
I have found that in the poorest of communities, what they want more than anything else is a job.
Absolutely. Not a small business.
Answer the technical question. This was 400. Statistically, it represented all parts of the city. So it's not a subset of inner city, but it represents the whole city.
That is correct. And we have enough. We did 400, so we could actually take a look at the white African American and Latino population.
Okay, thank you. That's all I want to know.
And there's not that much, and I'll tell you, when we just do Q&A, I'll pull it up really quickly to show you the cost of that one. Now, here's where they're going to cut. The thing that you celebrate, is the thing that they're most likely to cut. By the way, remember I said that the lowest priority was senior citizens?
Yes.
The thing that they want cut the least, senior citizens. They're not being hypocritical. What they're saying is what they've got now, they should have in the future. Nothing more, nothing less.
Yeah.
So I hate to do this because I know that you think this is the quality of the city. But that's what comes in first. And it comes across, once again, this is one of those topics that cut across race. But look, let's say that you're a supporter of arts and culture. What are you going to cut here? Nobody wants to cut anything here, but what are you going to cut? They're all difficult choices. They're horrific choices, but this is the choices they would make.
Do you have crosstabs on ages as well?
Yes.
And how did you conduct the survey? Was it a phone survey?
No, it's an online survey.
Well, that skews. I mean, an online survey certainly skews for higher income. Wouldn't you
no,
agree?
Everything was weighted to the demographic, to the census data from 2009. So we
but you have that backup for us?
Yes.
Everything
you're getting, not only getting the presentation, but getting the survey, the questionnaire, the cross tabs, all of that stuff. In terms of what people want from their government, it's not smarter, it's not better, smaller, less, limited. Are you efficient and are you effective? And efficiency and effectiveness are in the eyes of the beholder, not in your eyes. And I remember when a politician once said, wait a minute, there was a governor who said, we've now cut everything there is to cut, there's nothing left. And the population absolutely revolted. And they were screaming and hollering. Because you think that you're running efficiently and effectively, but they may not have that impression. And that's why I give you some of these language ideas to help you communicate with that. So what are they asking? And remember, this is all done in a comparison with the national data and the local data whenever possible. And for you all, it just screams out. You got two things that stand up over the national data. One is you need to prioritize established needs over personal wants. And I say to you that part of your relationship to them is how you prioritize what you do, and do they see that prioritization in how you relate to them.
I can't understand that. What do you mean over personal wants?
It could be politicians, it could be people. It's saying set priorities. You can't do everything. tell me what
they're saying. 36% are saying you need to prioritize the good of the group over the good of the individual.
Correct.
Okay.
And the second one is slightly lower, although it's still number one. Tighten its belt and balance its budget just like families do every month. So they are expecting you to cut. I'm going to repeat that again. They are expecting you to cut. Could you explain to them what the priorities are and get to the first competence you made, which is the greatest disconnect between cities? And Mike Bloomberg went through this in New York. He never explained the context of what he was doing. And he became really unpopular really quickly. And it took him 9 months to realize that he had to put forward a long-term plan. He had to say, we're going to do A, B, and C now so that we can have X, Y, and Z at the end. You don't have to make that mistake that he made. You should learn from it. I was not familiar with your Trinity River development project. Is anyone particularly responsible for that in here? You've got to fix your website. If I support that project, I'm looking for reasons. The way that I was going to ask this question was a paragraph on each of these. I went to your website and it doesn't connect me. It's not human, and it is human, but it doesn't tell me what it's going to be like. And if you guys, if someone's got it, you can pull it up. I'll give you specific examples of whatever changed. But I don't get a vision of how it's going to feel. I spent a lot of time in the Baltimore Harbor, and the changes. I don't know if you're familiar with the Baltimore used to look like and what it does now, or the National Harbor in Washington, D.C., or Philadelphia on South Street, the South Street Seaport. These are three great examples of an urban area that really was emotional and powerful in how they communicated. It was going to take 10 years from beginning to end, but what it was going to look like and what people were going to experience. When I went to the website, it was too clinical. It was very business-like, but it would not have given a resident a real feel of what's there.
Give me the three times. Give me Boston. Give me the other two.
Baltimore, Washington, and Philadelphia.
Thank you.
And there are others, but those are the ones. Oh, Texas. Well, the difference between what San Antonio, the Riverwalk. Give them a feel for what they're going to get there. And if you want to talk about it afterwards, I'm happy to give you some ideas.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Did you, are there no feeling for choices?
Yes.
Given?
Yes. So what do they want from you? Of all the data that we have, this stood out the most, other than the future. In America, they want stable and secure more than anything else. In Dallas, you all want prosperous and growing. You are not about a safety net. You are about reaching for the stars. Did any of you remember Casey Kasem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're not about keeping your feet on the ground. You're about reaching up.
What?
I guess, okay.
That's right. That's right.
I'm going back to fire.
You're right.
Here. But if your name is really JC, you got to be a little more successful so you can afford a real first and second name.
There you go.
Okay. Wait. Just for the record, it's again, not again. I don't see this. This just so stands out to me in the work that I do.
Have you ever seen this in any place in the United States?
Never. Never. So once again, I'm curious now about the culture. By the way, you know what used to be this way until 3 years ago? Las Vegas. I know. Now I just added the pale that doesn't get upset. Las Vegas had that feeling. Because no matter what happens, build it. Remember the phrase for Vegas? Build it and they will come. Well, that stopped 3 years ago, and it continues to get worse and worse. But this is just so dramatic. Okay. In terms of the infrastructure, please. Roads, don't use the word infrastructure. Roads. Bridges, highways, schools, sewers. If you use the word infrastructure, you lose the connection to what they appreciate. You've got to be specific about it. And the number one priority, You've got to be accountable. But now, let me show you the other thing that really stands out, and it's right here. You know, we've had this question over how people want to be represented. Every time that there's a question that involves the whole city, that's one of the options. It stands out. And again, I say to you, there is a desire among the public not to be divided. The public does not look at it the way you may look at it. They see themselves as one city, as one people, rather than inner city or suburb or whatever. This stands out. That if you show the citywide in scope, so that improvements will happen throughout the city. 14 points above the national average, the second highest priority above accountability. That also stands out for me in this desire to wrap your arms around everything. Do you feel safe walking it out in the area where you live? Gallup survey, nationwide is 70%. We do not have the city data, nationwide is the cities. In Dallas, it's 56-44. That should be a cause for work. That is not a great number. I think you guys would want to do better than that. Okay, now we're going into schools. First question is, how much time do I have?
You have, hold on here, you are...
No, the time, for free.
You started me 4 minutes. Remember, you started me...
Oh, I did start you late, thank you. 15 minutes.
You started me a half hour late.
Okay. 15 minutes, let's go. Let's see what you do.
This goes to your comments. The guy with the great shirt, you can't hear. You're right. You know, I give you that. Give him credit. Rayon looks so good on you're correct. You're correct. He's correct. 60%. We asked this question nationwide, what's the highest priority for local government? In Dallas, the schools dominate everything. I also don't see numbers like that anywhere. There's nothing close. We call them emergency services. Maybe you could quibble whether we called it police, fire, that stuff. But this is how we asked it nationally. So I wanted to duplicate it here. 60%. Wow. And if they could, among parents, 74% would send their kids to a different school. Yes, I put this towards the end, because this is the depressing part.
That isn't too much different than the U.S.
No, but you're still... But
I'm not making excuses.
I can't back down on this one, because here's the issue. If you ask the question, what are your schools? Give schools overall a grade, A, B, C, D, F. People always grade schools worse than their own schools. Why? Think about it. If you grade your own school badly, you're acknowledging that you're not a good parent. You're acknowledging that you're sending your child to a substandard school, so they never do it. So we asked the question in a very different way. I think it's an innovative way. I think this is a better way. When 3 out of 4 would send their kids to a different school if they could, you guys ought to look at this and go. Yes, sir.
How do you think they already public school, not private school?
These are two different. This is public and private.
So the survey would be a different survey versus it was broken down from public to private. And I said, the estimate says, I sent my kids to school, I sent my kids to a private school, I sent school in the down private school, the public school. So it would be a different answer versus if I sent my kids to a public school.
If this were only public school, those numbers would be even worse. As bad as this is,
yeah, it'd be worse. Right?
Yes. Actually, because I know we got the Dallas Morning News sitting back there. I do want to make that point again. This is a challenge. And this is something, when you get a number that high, that is also about the future. And people do care. Yes.
how much impact does the headlines on the newspaper that keeps on, you know, badgering school district, whether it's, which school district was it, Jessica or DeSoto that had the superintendent? DeSoto, I mean, it keeps on, and then, you know, because then you hear it in the neighborhood where before you didn't, but that was like the number one topic, even though it wasn't doubtful, it was, what are they going to do? You know, that's another school district. I just didn't know how much that would have impacted that.
I'm going to take it slightly broader, sure. Which is perception and reality. And anyone who's worked in city government knows that perception is reality.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Even if you think that things are okay, if they don't, and you run for office, they throw you out. If they don't, they come into your agency and they yell at you, or they complain about you. The issue with schools is that I have found even parents that are disconnected with their kids know what's going on. And they're sad, and I'll do this if you ever want to do this. You don't hate me when I'm done. Even if I'm on the side, actually. That's why I feel like you make connection. Sit in a room of 30 parents from the inner city, and they look at me, they look at me first and say, who's this white guy? Within 15 minutes, they're telling me what's going on. Within 30 minutes, they're in tears because they know what's going on and they don't know what to do about it.
Well,
I can't sit through this because the reason why I do what I do and how I do it is I become them. And I had a situation where it was about 7-8 months ago, and I was down in a city that was not as good shape as yours, and these women were in tears, and I had to stop because it was so bad. And they had answered the question in terms of the grades of their own schools for their kids between a B and a C. And the moment that I sat them down, and after 30 minutes, it wasn't between the B and the C. They were scared to death. And it was the girls, not the guys. They were scared for their daughters even more than their sons because of the bullying that was going on. And it was awful. And I didn't know what the hell to do because they're asking me at this point. I'm the moderator. As a human being, they're like, you're in a position of authority. Help us. What the heck am I supposed to do? So I see this number, it just gets me. Yes, sir.
How many people have you dealt with and talked with today that the school system was separate from the city government?
Most of them.
And most of them are separate?
Yes.
Okay. And I've been to PTA meetings, and we've been, most of the people have been door to door trying to get kids to come back to school. How does the city work with the school district to try to get, I mean, it's like our hands are tied.
Give me 3 or 4 weeks. I'm trying to figure out a way that I can get involved in L.A. This relationship with Villa Regosa just grows and grows and grows. And we are so different. And we have become so close. And I'm trying to figure out a way to get involved because he's exactly in that situation you are right now. So I can't answer it yet. I hope in 3 weeks to be able to answer it. Yes.
Well, what would you give us that answer once you get it?
Well, again, that depends on whether you'll still talk to me when you've got and your snacks, frankly, have to be better. Clearly, food matters to me. I'm in shape. Would you consider round to be a shape?
If parents are so aware of this shortcomings in their schools and they care so deeply, why is there such a disconnect between that concern and their voting? You know, the people who turn out to vote, it's terrible for city council. It's even worse for school board trustees. It's like 5% of people come out and vote. Is there a disconnect or a misunderstanding between the fact that these people really do shape what kind of education their children get? Do they not care? I mean, I don't understand why, if there's such depth of concern, people don't turn out and vote for the people who impact their children's education.
You know who votes? People over age 60 who don't have kids in school. That's step number one. And they will vote against funding for education unless you communicate to them that their grandchildren are going to get screwed. Number two, is that let's also be really frank about what's going on in the inner city. There, you have parents in there. You've got single moms who are under such pressure economically, are one paycheck away from losing wherever they live. They're not going to parent-teacher meetings. They're not connected in terms of voting. They're truly trying to survive.
You know, I truly agree with that because, you know, when we hold candidate forums in schools, nobody turns out, and it's because they don't have the time.
Right.
They're working a second job. But what about the fact that we don't even get competitive school board races?
Forget it. You're not going to do that. I'm going to tell you something to do.
Okay.
And this is awful. Offer them free groceries, and they will show up for the town hall meeting. Tell them that everyone will be able to take home a bag of groceries. I know it's got to be shocking that I'm saying this. Give them a bag of groceries, and they will come, but you hold them there to talk about the kids. And in fact, here's the deal. Give them a bag of groceries for, if they come. Give them a second bag if their kids come with them, and then you could have the discussion.
All right, we've moved to espousing policy and reporting, so let's report.
Can I ask your question? Yes, sir.
When you mentioned, when those older voters die, or some have, and you got this new generation coming, are they voting?
They voted in 2008. One wonders if they will vote in 2012. Oh, back here?
Mm-hmm.
Cash dollars is process. Accountability is process. Quality of students versus results. If you talk about the process in education, you're getting nowhere. They want to know what's actually happening. And this is not about language, this is about facts. It has to be fact-based. What do they want most? More money for teachers to reduce class sizes more than anything about pay for performance. But once again, Dallas stands out. 21% money for innovative technology to prepare for the 21st century. Once again, there's something in the heads of your citizens that are getting them to look forward rather than to the current time or looking back. And what do they want? I'd like to be able to say to you that there's a definitive answer like there is nationally. In this case, there is not. But a return to basics actually came in seconds to focus on the future. And it doesn't divide, that does not divide by race. That cuts across.
What does it mean until a return to basics?
A return to the basics.
Okay.
Could
it also mean
the
behind?
I ain't going there.
Corporate plans hit the
way.
Okay. As the final part, I'm going to spend just 5 minutes on my
5 minutes. I just wanted to disappear already. I'm with you.
There are money here.
I know. I was going to say, I actually left out three slides that specifically focuses on the mayor's weight. I'm not going to.
Number
one is simplicity. And I show this to you because I want you to be better communicators, not just in policy. You should be able to explain what you are doing in a sentence or a paragraph. Number three is credibility. You have to have specific facts, and you guys as a group, in fact, this is your slide for what you do tonight. This is where you guys sit down together and decide what are the statistics that we will be measuring. Because you can only use so many of them. Consistency. The reason why people often don't know what's going on in government is because you tell them one day, something different the next day, something different the day after. I like to tell people, I won't do that joke. Consequences of success and failure. I'm being so good today. Consequences. That's a powerful word. It's both good and bad. And it tells you what they will get, and it tells you what they may lose, and it matters. We can do better. They want something that is focused on continual improvement. As optimistic as they are, they want things to get even better than tomorrow. visualize. This goes back to the program that you're doing with the Trinity River. They need to be able to see what you are speaking of. For those of you who are going to be involved for the next 5-10 years, how can they see what Dallas is going to be like? This number 9, and you saw me do it here. How often do you ask questions of the audience you should speak in front of? I always begin my presentation by asking. Before I start to speak, it helps engage, and it helps create that interactivity. And the last thing I'd say to you is the why, therefore, so that. Why explains the problem, therefore is the solution, so that is the vision. Now, you guys are weakest, so that. You're actually the weakest in communication when you're explaining what things will be like if you're given the opportunity and everybody pulls together. You're great at explaining the problem. You're pretty good at explaining the solution. But you're not as good at explaining how things can be if you succeed. Here are the 5 things that they want you to do. Number 1 is accountability. Because they want you to admit when you made a mistake. You give them accountability, and they will give you trust. Second is fierce integrity and principles. And Mayor, this is something that I've gone before every political group, and they cringe. If someone does something wrong, they have to pay a price. You cannot protect people. If they think you don't have integrity, then they will trust nothing that you do, and they will have no confidence in the future. That third one, we talked about it briefly here, but this, I think, is for you, respect. They respect you for the job that you do. They may be angry with you, but they want to know that you respect them in a day-to-day basis. That fourth is independence. This is a nonpartisan election, I believe, for mayor. They don't want you to play party. They don't want you to play politics. They want you to be independent of the community, independent of business, independent of labor, independent of everything, so that you can take an overall view. And then they need to see measurable results. Now, they're not letting people out of your retreat until you decide what those measurable results will be. I can't answer that. This is what they want for you. These are the 21 words. You know what? I'm going to skip this because we've done enough language. I'm going to show you 2 other slides. Partnerships. Working together is a process. A partnership is a long-term commitment. Nobody wants to sacrifice. Why? Because everyone thinks they've sacrificed already. What they want to hear from you is that we're all in this together. I don't know who's responsible for environmental issues, but what they really want is a cleaner, safer, healthier Dallas. If you see the word sustainability in a city document, strike it. Strike it, strike it again. Cleaner, safer, healthier is all about the future. Sustainability is about the present. Rather than informing, they want to be educated, by the way, instead of society. And it's not community anymore. It's actually neighbors, the point that you made. We now see ourselves in terms of neighborhoods, and we want to promote that. And they don't care about what your approach is, it's the solution to the result. So let me show you the last thing, which is, I recommend others to others. It's a great place to live. Detroit, only 16% of Detroit residents recommend Detroit. 27% Philadelphia. You and Charlotte are at the top. This is based on a survey that was done in 2009 that Gallup did. Yeah, I don't know what St. Louis's numbers are.
That's a good number, though.
That's a great number. Can I answer? He wants me to leave. Can I get 2 last questions?
Yeah, a couple questions. Anything else to follow up? Yes, please.
Why are white people less optimistic than African Americans? What is the reason?
Oh, you really want me to go down that direction?
Yeah, go ahead. Come from Africa.
Go ahead.
And so on now. From African Americans.
There's a national perspective to it, which is a concern about the president. And a disagreement with the direction that he's headed.
Okay.
I disagree. I absolutely disagree. That's the reason. I think it's because white
Americans. Let me finish first, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. Rick Perry. White Would you interrupt me?
I apologize
for interrupting you. Okay. Sorry, I apologize for comparing you to Rick Barry. If you want to apologize for.
Okay, let's get to the
point. Yeah, okay.
That's number one. That's one of the concerns. Number two is a feeling that the economy that they remember from years ago isn't the economy of the future. They're very much afraid of jobs going to China, and they feel more closer.
Quite closer?
Yes. Number three is the education system, and which is one of the reasons why they're trying so hard to get the kids out of public schools into private schools, which creates a nightmare in itself. So there's a consequence to that. And part of it's what caused the rise of the Tea Party.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a sense that America isn't what it was, and they want to go back to the way things were. And now I got taught something, because the phrase taking America back was something that I was doing for a research project, and one of your mayoral colleagues said to me, and I'm trying to remember which one it was, it may have been from D.C., said to me, wait a minute, when you say taking America back for African Americans, what they hear is taking America back to the 1950s. For the 1960s, that they don't want to go back to the way things were 50 or 60 years ago.
Right.
The white Americans taking America back is Leave It to Beaver days. For an African American, taking America back is days of segregation, which I thought was really fascinating. And I would have said that if I'd not been jumped on. There's no reason, but here's the issue, is that what this survey tells me is that they believe that we're all in this together, your residents do. And they believe that there shouldn't be a division by race, a division by neighborhood. And if that they exist, what can you do as city officials to break down those barriers? And what I've also found is the more communication, the better. That you open up town hall meetings that are interracial are going to be the most successful of all. Because when people hear from each other, then they relate to each other. Then they can connect to each other. But we don't do it. People watch their cable news programs based on what they agree with.
That's right.
Everyone who watches MSNBC, almost everybody who watches it regularly voted for Barack Obama. Almost everyone who watches Fox voted for John McCain. So we don't get our news anymore to inform us. We get it to affirm us. Which is why newspapers like this are so important. Because you're read across racial lines. You're read across generational lines. That's important that it reaches out to everybody.
Frank, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And this has been great. Appreciate it. Frank, send me the data. We'll get all the cross tabs and make sure everybody gets what they want.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
it.
Time ends at 5:20.